Chapter 21. Mime Interview. Hungry Paul arrived at the headquarters of the National Mime Association a little early. It was in a theatre that had used to be the Muse House of a larger property, and which had to be accessed through a back lane. Outside there was a mural showing a white-faced mime artist with a surprised expression, and a poster advertising a show that had taken place the previous year. Beside the entrance, there was a painted picture of a doorbell with a sign above it saying, "Please knock." The ticket desk, come reception, was unattended, so Hungry Paul let himself in, but decided not to call "hello" into the empty room, in case that was against the house rules. The theatre was small, with about 50 foldable metal chairs, and looked like a screening room, which is what it had been before the National Mime Association took it over. Earlier that morning, he had left Parley View without telling his parents where he was going. He didn't want their expectations on his mind when he had such mixed feelings about the interview in the first place. If he failed the interview, or was offered the job and turned it down, he didn't want to have the whole drama of discussing it over the dinner table afterwards, with his parents gently pushing him along with a "how about this?" and a "what about that?" If Hungry Paul was being entirely honest about it, he was a little fuzzy on why he was doing the interview in the first place. It had all started when he was enjoying Arno's routine at the Chamber of Commerce prize-giving as he entertained the congregating well-wishers by making jokes about the giant cheque, which he pretended to saw with his hand, or by playing with the President's chains of office, which he pretended to spit and polish. Afterwards, he saw Arno sitting down, smoking a cigarette and eating a normal sandwich normally, and was a little disappointed to see that mime artists did regular stuff too. They got chatting, with Arno seemingly under the impression that Hungry Paul was a successful, i.e. rich, businessman who was a big noise in the Chamber of Commerce. Arno opened up and explained how he had started studying drama and dance and then got into mime when his college put on a musical version of Mr. Bean. From there, he moved to Paris and studied with the last generation of master mime artists who by then had become resigned to the decline of the silent arts. He became involved with the National Mime Association after they had advertised for a creative director. Though they had little or no money to pay him, he was able to live rent-free in a small bedsit behind the stage of the theatre. He managed to make enough money from teaching and corporate work to keep himself and the association going, provided he was able to rent the theatre out for yoga classes twice a week and to a film club every second Friday. The problems were not just financial. Morale in the mime world was at an all-time low. Some of the most talented mimes had switched to doing the whole living statue thing as a form of street theatre. However, when that proved to be quite lucrative, it began attracting a number of charlatans, who dressed up but wore masks and were even happy to move around and do a thumbs up for photos with tourists. Arno decided to put a stop to this, and while he would hold his hand up and say that he had made some mistakes, and that some things were said which perhaps shouldn't have been, overall his intentions were true, in that he wanted to preserve the integrity of the great art of mime, which had been handed down to him by the masters. But it had been a divisive move, which alienated some of the best members of the troupe, and which discouraged the new joiners who had got involved with the theatre for drama of a different kind. The National Mime Association needed to repair its public image, and Arno accepted that he was not the man to do it, so he was moving back to the Netherlands and leaving the creative direction of the association to his young apprentice, Lambert. And so began the search to find someone from the outside to bring fresh ideas and act as their spokesman in restoring their reputation in the real world. He figured that Hungry Paul, with his connections at the Chamber of Commerce, could be just the man to lead the National Mime Association to a better place. The fact that he was also a skilled performer, which Hungry Paul later worked out was a reference to his silent acceptance speech at the prize-giving, seemed like a gift from the Muses. Naturally, there would have to be a process for filling the job, as the post was being funded in part by an Arts Council bursary. So Hungry Paul needed to do an interview if that was not too unreasonable a request. In the days since Arno had laid all this out for him, Hungry Paul might have wondered what it was that stopped him disabusing Arno of his mistaken assumptions, and why his usual instinct to recoil from new opportunities had not been triggered. But Hungry Paul was not a man to ponder endlessly the whys and how comes of life. He simply assumed that silence, like yawns and itches, was contagious. The gentle pull of interest which arose within him, unbidden and unexplained, was the awakening of his inner silence in resonance with the powerful external forces of mime. Hungry Paul sat himself in the front row of the theatre and waited quietly and patiently. He was wearing his wedding suit, but with the shirt from his postal uniform underneath, that being the only other shirt he had which didn't have double cuffs. In fact, it was short-sleeved and didn't have cuffs at all. Whenever he took the jacket off, the combination of short sleeves and a tie made him look like a manager in a fast-food restaurant. With no mobile phone, he was not tempted to scroll through his texts or refresh his social media feed. His freedom from restlessness meant that he didn't explore his nasal cavities or fiddle with his zip. His mental stillness left him untroubled by the passage of time or the spooky, run-down emptiness of the place. Standing behind the stage curtain, hidden and peeking through a gap, were Arno, Lambert, and the chair of the interview board, Mr. Davenport, from the Arts Council. They marvelled at Hungry Paul's composure and were humbled by his profound inactivity. After 15 minutes of observation, they were in no doubt that they had their man. They exchanged notes excitedly among themselves and agreed on the outcome, which Mr. Davenport had pointed out was no mere formality, even though there had been no other candidates. The three interview board members emerged from behind the stage curtain and congratulated the successful candidate. Hungry Paul greeted Arno with a handshake, to which Arno responded by miming as if it had been a bone crusher that broke his hand and made him dizzy. As he lay on the floor, Lambert tried to revive him before acting out an improvised last rites service and doing a digging action to bury him. Mr. Davenport tried to join in, but soon found himself out of his depth, utterly out-mimed by the other two, who wore their years of training lightly indeed. For obvious reasons, the practicalities of signing the contract and coming to terms was not done through the medium of mime, as labour law did not yet allow for that. The initial contract was to be for 11 months, but Mr. Davenport hinted strongly that these things were often rolled over if everything went well. The Arts Council would fund half the cost of Hungry Paul's salary, with the balance to come from the National Mime Association's own resources, including corporate and yoga income, as well as gate receipts, if any. Hungry Paul was also offered the bedsit behind the stage once Arno moved out, which was counted as an executive perquisite. He had asked to see the bedsit he was being offered, but this had not been possible, as Arno's girlfriend was still asleep in there, which may or may not have been the reason why Arno had suggested to Mr. Davenport that they should conduct the job interview in silence. The job spec, which had been prepared in order to get the Arts Council on board, envisaged a panoramic range of responsibilities. Hungry Paul's main job was to motivate and inspire enthusiasm nationally for mime and the silent arts, excluding living statues and tableau vivant. He was also to represent the perspective of the mime community in public discourse, as well as answering any mime-related questions that came in to the Arts Council help desk. While the Chamber of Commerce prize money meant that Hungry Paul was not particularly concerned about the paltry pay that came with the post, he could still drive a bargain when he needed to. He insisted on two conditions. First, that he would keep his Mondays free so that he could continue to honour his obligations to the post office. And secondly, that he would not be required to carry a mobile phone. The National Mime Association and the Arts Council agreed on both counts, as they were only offering the job on a 3-day week, and besides, they hadn't the money to pay for a phone. With the deal made, Arno left Lambert to brief Hungry Paul on his new position, while he showed Mr. Davenport to his car. Lambert, unsure of how much time he had before Arno came back, was all brevity and candour. Arno's return to the Netherlands, he confided, could not come soon enough. the National Mime Association was in a complete mess. The theatre had not put on a show in over a year, what little money came in went straight back out again, and mime, as an art form, no longer caught the imagination of the general public, with the younger generation scarcely aware of its existence. The theatre had become no more than a cobwebbed storeroom with boxes and old posters lying around, such that even the yoga teachers had started to wonder whether the low hourly rates were worth it. With no sign of Arno's return, a fact noted knowingly by Lambert, they walked towards the bike stand where Lambert had parked his black and white striped bicycle, which had a bell with a clanger decommissioned. Hungry Paul liked Lambert and waved him off with the reflection that there was something special about the way that quiet people just seemed to find each other in life. The day had been a hectic one by Hungry Paul's standards. Job interviews can be draining, so it was not surprising that he fell asleep on the train home, his temple vibrating against the glass. When he arrived at Parley View, his mother was on the phone to Grace about the table settings for the wedding, and his dad was on the laptop writing a letter to the editor of The Economist. As Hungry Paul paused at the doorway, reluctant to interrupt them, the urge to break the news about his new job seemed to pass, and the announcement slipped back down his throat. Tired, but satisfied, he decided to go upstairs and hang his good suit in the wardrobe, just in case it got crumpled. He took off his docks and lay back on his bed in just his pants and vest to reflect on the corporate complications he had just inherited. It seemed to him that the Mime Theatre, in its state of disrepair and irrelevance, had come to mirror the fate of silence itself. But how could he even begin to restore the position of mime as a unifying and humanizing force in the world when the silent community itself was divided? Hungry Paul stared at the stippled ceiling and bathed in the quiet all around him. He tuned his ears to listen to the ever-present silence itself, rather than the bubbles of noise that floated in it. He began to appreciate its profound scale. All major spiritual and philosophical traditions throughout history had emphasized the value of silence. The universe, whether expanding or contracting, does so amidst a vast ocean of it. The Big Bang sprang from it and will one day return to it. And yet, silence, for all its ubiquity and timelessness, had found itself at odds with the clamorous nature of modern mankind. This noisy, opinionated world had made an enemy of silence. It had become something unwelcome, to be broken or filled. Staring at the Spitfire mobile on his ceiling, it was as though the answer had been with him all along and was simply waiting to be noticed. He realized that before the public could be persuaded about mime, they would first have to be put in the contact with silence itself. For the power of mime lies in its ability to touch the silence within us all. Feeling inspired, he lifted the stumpy pencil from his bedside table and sketched the following. Sunday Night Quiet Club. 1 hour of sitting quietly at the National Mime Association Theatre. Free admission, all welcome. First Sunday of every month at 8 p.m. You may wish to note the above. Its simplicity was its perfection. It had taken someone with the special insight of Hungry Paul to realize that the answer to the problem, strange though it seemed, was to get people to do nothing. He also decided to invite the statue artists to attend in full costume and to perform in silence for the duration of the Sunday Night Quiet Club meeting. He hoped that the request, made with deference and a degree of artistic sensitivity, would be enough to persuade them that a new era of close collaboration was being offered by their friends in the mime world. As he heard his parents starting to make dinner noises downstairs, he snapped out of his executive preoccupations and looked for something comfortable to change into after a very adult-feeling day. Though this was all still quite new to him, he could see that making big decisions was just as consequential as not making them. Either way, you were committing to something. We are never entirely outside of life's choices. Everything leads somewhere.